wake up. Yeah. Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are free. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet. Not by chance.
And the big question for tonight, are children better off when they have siblings? Did you know that there's a worldwide trend towards one-child families, that mothers with only one child are happier than mothers of multiple children, or that of children that are not bossy, selfish, or poorly justified, or adjusted is a better word. Our guest, Susan Newman, she's a social psychologist, a parenting expert, written more than 15 books, including her latest, The Case for the Only Child, Your Essential Guide, and she's appeared on 2020, GMA, The Today Show, and many other programs. And she's the author of Psychology's Today, Singleton's Blog, and Let Us Say. Susan, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The Case for the Only Child, what was it that caused you in the very beginning to take a look at this issue and delve in the way you've done?
Somebody had to do it. No, really, what? I have an only child, and practically as soon as he was born, people kept saying, when are you having another? And I kept saying, what's wrong with an only child? And that was 20-plus years ago I started looking into it. And you know, the problem for so many mothers with one child is that they are pressured. They feel a lot of shame and guilt, and then they feel that their singleton should have a sibling. And it really stems from these long-held stereotypes that today have no basis in fact. So I just wanted to try to help people decide, you know, that when you or learn there isn't anything wrong with an only child, one, and how to deal with their feelings, the pressure, and also the economics, you know. There are a lot of reasons why the single child is the fastest-growing family unit today.
Susan, I can see whereby, you know, the old style, the old thinking was, you know, your family, you got, you know, 15 kids and everybody's happy and you're screaming and yelling and mom's staying home and she's cooking and cleaning and taking care of the kids and dad's out making money for the family, etc. That's a very old model, and it's a model that doesn't exist anymore. And I think the major problem today, let's say with the family that has one child, if the parents are going to bond with that child and give that child what it needs, I'd say spot on, do it. But I would venture to guess there's a training program a parent has to go through to say this is what a parent is and this is how you bond with your children.
That's absolutely right. But you know, what people have this image in their head that a family with one child isn't a family. Yet the parenting skills are the same. Single children turn out just as well as children with siblings. It's really the parenting. It's not the number of children that are in a family that determines how your child will turn out. And I don't think people understand that. I think people feel that there's something wrong with the only child, that they must have a sibling. But, you know, this goes back to a study that was done in 1896 where a psychologist said all these nasty things about only children, and they've stuck. And it's much like other stereotypes. You know, you hear only children are lonely and bossy and maladjusted and aggressive. But the fact is they aren't. And as a parent of an only myself, and I think most other mothers and fathers, they worry that their only child will be lonely. And that definitely isn't the case anymore. Sure, it's harder when your only child is very young, before preschool. But after that, only children are socialized so early with daycare and pre-kindergarten and all these mommy and me programs and then after-school activities that they're not lonely anymore. Plus, we have technology as they get older, you know, instant messaging, the computer.
Sure.
And a very huge study was done at the University of Ohio, and I love the title of it. It was called Siblings, Good for Nothing. And the study found out that only children have as many friends, are just as popular as kids with siblings. So, you know, the stereotypes, you know, if I asked you who told you only children were lonely and spoiled and selfish, I mean, can you remember who told you that?
Well, actually, I never heard that. No, by the way.
Okay, you're in the minority.
No, but I've never heard that. No, I came from a family, you know, we had three boys and a girl. So I came from a family where there were kids in the family. But I never thought about, which is a good thing that you're bringing it up, I had never really thought about an only child, whether there was a problem or not. And you said something early on as we began the interview. You had said something about, you know, the mothers with the guilt and the rest of it. And I can imagine that that has to go on. But how do you pass that by? How do you move through that if you, you're planning a family and you decide, well, I want one. But what you're supposed to do, you notice that I say supposed to do. What you're supposed to do is you're supposed to have 2-3 kids if you're going to have a family. That's not necessarily so anymore. But how do you get through, how do you move through the guilt and the cultural, the cultural traps that you can fall in and the messages that will cause a problem in your life?
Well, a lot of women are realizing that, you know, because they're working, you know, the majority of women have to work today to support the family, and the cost of raising children. Plus, there's a huge infertility issue now because women are starting their families much later. They come to realize, at least the people that I've talked to, that for many of them, they're so happy to have one, and that there's, as the stigma of only children subsides, they get over their guilt. And as one woman said to me, I only look forward, I don't look back, and I've never regretted my decision. When they see that their children are happy and that they can give them more things, and more advantages, I think they slowly move toward this is okay. And of course, as the numbers of only children keep rising, they have a lot of company. You know, but it is hard to deal with the judgmental people around you who are still have this old mentality.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe when you come down to it, that the mentality, whether it be the new mentality, the old mentality, there still is, and I'm going to go right back to where I was in the very beginning of this, is there's got to be that process where if you're going to be an only child, if you can have that closeness, that acceptance from the family and actually feel part of the family, being an only child couldn't be that bad. If you got a dad around and you want some quote-unquote male advice, you go to your mom for whatever it is that your mom's going to give you as far as advice goes. And in essence, a one-child family can be a perfect thing. And you also mentioned before with the economy today, the cost to have 3 or 4 kids, it's very hard for a family to even survive. And a one-child family, there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, the costs are staggering. You can't. No one wants to put a price tag on children. But in middle income families, it's costing $286,000 to get your child to age 18. And those of us who go to the grocery store know, or will be shocked to see, or not shocked, that $46,000 of that is for food. So when and no college. So you know, people are really thinking about what makes them happy. What can I do to make my child happy? And can I really cope with more children and a job and the costs? You know, and then there's always the husband who wants another and the wife who doesn't. And where did this all come from? You know, how many children you think you want, which doesn't always happen today, often stems from what you grew up with. If you had two siblings and you thought that was great, then you want to have two siblings. So you have to also solve the husband-wife or partner conflict over what kind of family they grew up in and, you know, how many each of them wants. So, you know, that becomes an issue, too, and sometimes an impasse.
Yeah, but, no question about it. But we're starting to run out of time. But, Susan, when someone meets and you decide to get into a relationship and you decide that you are going to get married and you are going to have a family, those things should be discussed in front. I think that's really where the major problems are. You get into a situation, you don't think about it, you rush into it, you get married, now you're going to have a family. But what's a family mean? Define the family. And I think that's some of the biggest problems that we're talking about here. A single child family, or, you know, five kids in the family, you got to define what that family is, and if you're both in agreement, you go for it. If not, then you got a problem there, and you better address it before it addresses you. Now, with that, Susan, we're just about out of time. Yeah. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It's www.SusanNewmanPhD.com.
Wonderful. And can we buy the book there?
You can buy the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and in bookstores.
You know, let me tell you what, very quickly before we let this go. I saw something in the market about a week ago. I came from a world where when things were expensive, it didn't have the same definition of expense as we have it today. When I was a kid, I used to smoke, and cigarettes were 18 cents a pack. And I walked into the market the other night and happened to take a look at the cost of a carton of cigarettes, $72. And I thought that in and of itself tells me what's happened to the cost of things. And with that, Susan Newman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Good night.
Exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Healing and author, practitioner, healing practitioner, Crystal Sage is with us, formerly a licensed health insurance agent. She's worked in the healing arts nearly 20 years now, successfully helping others to heal. Many success stories are chronicled in her new book, Heal Beneath the Surface, Become Your Own Best Healer, Using True Healing Solutions. Crystal, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. When we talk about healing and we talk about different diseases, etc., is there a base place that this all comes from? And when I say a base place, is there a common denominator, an overarching theme that if you're going to get sick, you can usually find this as a root cause at base?
Yes. There's actually I've boiled it down to two basic common denominators, and the two main causes of all disease comes from either toxins or deficiencies of some sort. So now there's many different toxins and there's many different kinds of deficiencies, but it's basically going to fall under one of those two categories.
Do most physicians, most allopathic physicians, chemicals, do they realize this? How many people go to a doctor and get a diagnosis and they treat the symptoms and not really the cause of what the problem is? Are we running into a problem that most people don't know what to look for to be able to fix something? Because if I don't see it, I can't fix it.
Right. Well, that's the whole problem is because we've been conditioned to treat in this manner of just treating symptoms. And that's why I ended up in the condition that I was in, and that was the condition that I had. I didn't know any different. I just watched my mother and my aunt all of my life go back and forth to the doctor, back and forth, and back and forth to the hospital and getting more drugs and more drugs and more drugs. Luckily, though, that fueled me into the right direction, all that bad conditioning. It, you know, somewhere in my noggin, it told me that wasn't working.
No. And as a matter of fact, we are in a drug-oriented society. And one of the things I know you talk about, you know, fear, and that word is very important. Today, we're starting to change this. But for the most part, you go to the doctor's office and you're, the minute you get in there, your blood pressure goes up, your mouth dries out, and you know something's wrong. Now, the doctor will come back after a diagnosis or a potential or the possibility of certain things. And you're scared to death. And the doctor's the be-all, end-all, know-all. And whatever the doctor says is what you do. And that, we found over the years, is a problem because they're not all specialized in certain areas. And what they tell you to do sometimes is not the right thing to do.
Well, I would like to say that most of the time it's not the right thing to do, because what they've been trained to do is to treat symptoms. With drugs and surgery are primarily symptom treatment type of treatments. And so until you get to the cause, so that's what my whole book is about. The reason why I named my book Heal Beneath the Surface is because until you start taking responsibility and start taking the right actions and heal beneath the surface, you won't heal completely. It's impossible to heal completely if you are only treating symptoms. It's actually impossible. So the purpose of me writing my book was to help end needless pain and suffering. I mean, if I could turn the sad condition that I was in, hitting complete bottom, I mean, I had everything wrong with me, Michael. I had everything wrong. You couldn't be too much worse off than I was, hitting bottom. I had blood sugar problems. I had fibromyalgia, PMS, kidney stones, irritable bowel, angina, heart pains. And in those days, they called fatigue, the kind of fatigue that I had, chronic fatigue immune deficiency disorder. Nice, fancy name.
Sure.
For a very dim type of condition that they didn't know what to do with. Then after that, a little longer after that, then cancer. So you couldn't have been too much worse off than I was. I was dysfunctional. I had every symptom you can practically imagine. Couldn't even see straight, talk straight, think straight.
Now, let me ask you this. Was it the cancer that triggered it for you to take a look at what life is really all about and take a look at the different options that we have in medicine today?
Well, I think it was my mother and my aunt's conditioning. that watching them, learning that that was not working. And so I wanted to do something different. And it was not easy. I have to tell you, there was a lot of ups and downs. The purpose of writing my book is so that what I did learn from it, though, Michael, is that it's not that difficult. It's actually pretty simple. But because I was so ignorant and had to learn everything from scratch, it was difficult for me. I had no knowledge whatsoever about natural healing. Absolutely none. I had no exposure to it. We didn't even have vitamins in our house growing up. So I had to learn virtually from scratch. But what I learned was so valuable, and now I want to be able to teach others because they don't have to. It's all preventable. 99% of chronic disease is within your control, and it's preventable.
Now, doesn't that all
have to do? If I can turn around my condition, as bad as it was, you can certainly prevent it.
Now, by the way, does it all have to do with the immune system? Now, I'm not a clinician, but after all of the years of talking to people and doing interviews, et cetera, and digging into health, and I, like everybody else, have my own problems, does it boil down to the immune system? You know, nobody's going to give you anything to cure anything, not even the doctors. What we do is we shore up that system. It's your own body's responsibility to fix you. And if your body has the right ammunitions, quote unquote, to do the job, then you get fixed. If you don't have the right ammunition to do the job, then your body deteriorates and all of the problems really begin to start, and you don't have the energy and the will and the desire to move through life.
Well, that's exactly right. And you could say the immune system, if you want to compartmentalize it, you know, into sections, but it has to do with the whole body. But of course, the immune system, once you strengthen your immune system, then it can take care of yourself. But to be fair, and the only factors that separate those who have chronic disease right now and those who have already healed themselves is knowledge. That's it. Once you learn what to do, I basically broke it down into knowledge, belief, faith, and taking the right actions. Once you have the right knowledge, then you can take the right actions. But to be fair, there's you won't even read in most natural health books. There's something that I will tell you that most natural health books don't even know to tell you. There's a big, huge missing link. And that is, even people that are doing the right thing, say, I think you would agree, and most people would agree, that nutrition is the foundation of health. Could we agree on that?
Absolutely.
Do you think most people would agree with that?
No.
Okay. Well, maybe, okay, if some people might have a hard time with that. Those people might agree that it takes nutrients for the body to function properly.
Crystal, I'm on your side with this. I totally, absolutely acknowledge everything you're saying, and I believe that. That's how I live my life. You asked me the question, you said, would most people say that? And I'd say no. And there's a reason they would say no, because they don't know any better. It's
okay.
Not what you don't. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's say that it takes, disease and aging occur when the cells die faster than they are being replaced. And it takes nutrition in order to regenerate your cells and turn that whole process around. So what I'm getting at, what I'm leading up to actually be fair, is that even people who are doing the right things on the natural health side, people that are doing the right things and eating, juicing and eating the most organic food on the planet, there's a reason why those people, even if they're doing the right things, will not reach the top of the healing mountain. It's one of the biggest missing links in the natural healing side, that if people don't know about it, they won't ever reach the top of the healing mountain, and that is nutritional allergies. Now, a lot of people know about food allergies, but they're not making the connection that they're also allergic to the nutrients. So if they're allergic to the nutrients, then they're not ever going to be able to reverse that process.
Now, how do you tell? How can you find out whether you're allergic to nutrients or not?
Well, some people already know. They already know what their food is doing to them, and basically a portion of their food that they're eating is becoming toxic. So to the degree of the allergy condition, whatever degree that is, that portion of your food and nutrients is becoming toxic. There is a group of doctors now that have been trained by Dr. Devi Nambutrapad. She has a system that she teaches. It's called Nambutrapad's Allergy Elimination Technique. And she's now taught, I went through her training myself, she has now taught thousands of doctors nationwide and abroad how to do this technique. And they can do it with just by simple means. A lot of people have heard of muscle testing.
Sure.
Or kinesiology.
Yep.
Just by simple means of kinesiology and muscle testing, they test you with allergy test vials. And there's a very, very simple treatment that they go through systematically and reverse the allergies one by one by one by one. And as these nutritional allergies are being reversed, so are their chronic diseases.
Okay, now, how do you get a hold of something like that, or would you come to you personally for that?
Well, people can come to me personally, or they can search for a doctor that might be in their area. They can go to my website and get the resources at truehealingsolutions.com or in my book, Heal Beneath the Surface. And it explains this whole process. And more importantly, what my book also teaches people, and one of my main number one motivations is to remove the fear that people have that's surrounded with disease. There's so much fear connected to the names of the diseases. And so what my whole book is, one of the main things is to eliminate the fear by describing disease in more generic terms and showing people that through the process of them eliminating their nutritional allergies, I've done it myself with hundreds of people, including myself, that just that alone, they'll have great improvement just by reversing their allergies.
Crystal, the people are frightened to death of one thing really and one thing only, and they're frightened of dying when it comes to anything that's got to do with health. And if they can get in their mind that they don't have to die, that's not promising them anything, but they don't have to die. Take this step, and take that step based on what other people have done. Then you can be, you know, you can live a life. Now, my question is the training that you had, if somebody was looking for that kind of a training in a particular area, how would they find it?
Right. That's what my classes and my book is all about. My classes are named Become Your Own Best Healer. Now, some people may not be ready to take on, you know, that full responsibility, but with the knowledge will help eliminate the fear. So that's what I'm trying to just get the knowledge out there. I mean, my gosh, if I could do it, if I could turn around my condition, you certainly could too.
No question about it. Crystal, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at?
TrueHealingSolutions.com, and you can purchase the book right from the website, or you can go into any bookstore and ask them to order it.
Wonderful. Hey, Crystal, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night.
There's Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And if the control room angel is floating over the equipment, he might even tell me whether or not the guest appeared.
The guest did appear.
Oh, good. Angels from all over the place.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom.
Robin Sigmund with us is the author of Renovation Boot Camp Kitchen Design, Remodeling Your Kitchen Without Losing Your Wallet, Your Mind, or Your Spouse. She's an award-winning certified kitchen designer, registered interior designer, a writer, a speaker, as well as a popular TV and a radio guest. Robin, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, thank you. I stood at attention when I realized you were the renovation drill sergeant.
And you'd best do that, too. Keep in mind that I'm going to be tough.
I got it. And by the way, you should be. Well, I really believe that. Well, you really should be, because one of the things that I believe for a long time, a kitchen in and of itself, look at the things that are in a kitchen that you can get into trouble with. And trouble with meaning, you know, it could be electric, it could be gas, it could be any number of these things, that it can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing in the construction and putting it together.
That is such a great point. I'm so glad you brought that up, because it is the most dangerous room in the house to renovate if you don't know what you're doing. As you pointed out, there's electricity, there's gas, there's plumbing, and a lot of people will think, well, plumbing, that's no big deal. I've done plumbing before. But I'll tell you something. I was on a job site once and with a professional plumber, a licensed plumber. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody, you know, kind of every once in a while you get lazy and you cut corners and whatever, and this is a professional guy. We were in a condo. There were no shutoffs in the unit itself, and we were on the 32nd floor. And rather than go downstairs and get them to turn off the shutoffs, he decided he would just kind of tighten something under the sink. Well, the something that he decided to tighten blew off. He got scalded with hot water. The nut, I mean, it could have killed him if it hit him in the head. It just grazed his ear. But until he could get down 32 flights to get them to turn off the shutoffs, we had gallons and gallons of water pouring into the condo, and it ruined everything. We were within 24 hours of a six-month renovation of having the owners move back in. Disaster. So, and that's a professional guy. So imagine if you don't really know what you're doing, it can be very dangerous.
Now, when we deal with kitchens today, and obviously, I won't say obviously, but for me, from what I've seen over the years going into people's homes, you usually end up in the kitchen. The kitchen is that place where everybody seems to hang out. The kitchen is the favorite place. It's the family place, getting away from watching TV in the living room or whatever. But the kitchen is an extremely important room, and I've seen time and time again when somebody was looking to buy a house. I've done the same thing when I walked into a place and I was interested buying, renting, whatever the case may be. The first thing I go to is the kitchen.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know why it's the most important room in the house, do you?
Food.
Yeah, exactly. It's where we nourish our families, and food is a very primal thing for people. And so, you know, from time immemorial, families would sit around food and talk about the important things that they had to decide. And, you know, in our families today, people will sit around the dinner table. They'll discuss what happened with their day. If they have a problem, that's generally where they work it out. All of the important family discussions are generally done around a kitchen table, around food. So it's natural that that's where everybody gravitates to. So that's why it's so important to do the kitchen properly and do it the way you like it so that it's going to make you feel good. Because honestly, it makes such a huge difference to the way you live your life if you feel good in your house.
Yeah, and when we come down to it also, when people want to do it themselves as far as, the kitchen, the construction, and the rest of it, by the time you're done and you've spent the money that you were going to spend plus five times that you didn't know you would have had to spend to get the projects that you're doing, you could have hired a professional in the first place.
Well, and I find that time after time. And so that's why in my book, actually, I've got a schedule of events and procedures and processes so that you know the things that have to go first and what needs to be done. Because let's face it, not everybody is going to hire a professional. They should, but they're not going to. So at least with this book, they're going to find out what they need to do in the right order. And so it takes them through scheduling. It takes them through budgeting. It takes them through all of the players involved. And really, in one kitchen, believe this or not, you can have over 150 people involved in your kitchen. A lot of them you don't see. They're behind the scenes at various vendors. But if one person makes an error, of course, it causes a chain reaction, which can cause problems. And so it helps to know these things, what's going on behind the scenes, because if you don't know, it's that much more upsetting when it happens.
Well, let's take it a step farther. I've done a tremendous amount of interviews over the years about people with addictions. Now, academics walk in and they try to work with somebody that has an addiction. It doesn't work. You got to have somebody who's been there, who's done that, to really help some. If somebody has an alcohol addiction, they need somebody who's been on the program and had a problem themselves that they can relate to, which brings it to this. An architect is the academic. They're not the ones, like people like yourself, who have been there, who have done that, who know what it's like to be, underneath that tool to get the job done. So it's critical that you get somebody who knows what they're doing, that functions every day in this kind of a venture.
That's such a great point, and you're absolutely right. And I like to refer to architects as equivalent to a general practitioner. And if you've got a toothache, that's not who you go to. You go to a specialist who's a dentist. Same thing with a kitchen. There are so many details to be concerned with in the kitchen that you really want to make sure that you've got someone on your team who's done it, hundreds of times before. But not only that, who really knows the ins and outs of a kitchen renovation. And, I have not met many architects who can do that, not to take anything away from them. They are fabulous professionals, obviously, but we all have our strengths, and I think we should recognize that.
Now, by the way, and when we talk about strengths, I was brought up in the Los Angeles area, and when I was 41, 42 years old, I went to Fairbanks, Alaska. I was living in the interior for about 20-some-odd years. Now, the interesting thing there, which happens to be germane to what we're talking about, 30 years ago, I couldn't even spell hammer. Now I own five of them, right? You learn to survive. And my ex-wife and I owned some property up there, and somebody was moving in, and there was a problem with the toilet. So a buddy of mine who did construction came in. He says, "Okay, I'll fix the leaks and the rest of it, but we've got to put a new floor in here." So I grab my, I grab my Sawzall, and I'm ready to rock. And I got in there, and I'm standing there without a shirt on. It's in the middle of the summer. I got a towel wrapped around my head, and I'm sweating, and I've got a chainsaw out there, and I'm getting rid of the wood. And I happen to hit a pipe that had to do with the boiler, and the scalding water was shooting all over the place. Okay. Now, I've never did that kind of a job again, but the point was I knew next time never to do anything like that. I did the job. I fell down. I got back up again, and I knew what not to do the second time. You go to people who know what not to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, that's not to say that there aren't going to be problems, because, quite frankly, I've been in this business almost 20 years, and I can count on probably one hand the number of renovations that I've been involved with that haven't come across some problem or other. But the thing is that when you're dealing with people who have done it for years and years and years and hundreds of them, they are more likely to be able to come up with a solution that's going to solve your problem faster than you could if you don't have the experience. You're going to have to, call somebody or find somebody who can help you or knows what to do in this situation or God forbid, open the book at that point. That's too late,
Sure.
You want to know the stuff before you get into trouble.
Yeah, and by the way, the best part of that story, there was a sweet young woman and her husband. They were university professors up at the school there. Very shy, very sweet, very introverted. And about the time I hit that pipe with the chainsaw, I yelled out a couple of four-letter expletives at the top of my lung, and she happened to walk around a corner at the time, and she looked at me, and she went, whoops, and she disappeared. So it
that
happened.
That is such a lovely reaction. How understated.
And it happens. Now, let me ask you this. Why kitchens for you? And when I say that, that everybody gets into a particular area and then they zoom in on something because that light bulb goes out, and Robin, there was something in it for you that caused you to find out what you found out and stayed with it.
Well, it's kind of a convoluted story, as most of our careers go. I hear from other people that they kind of fall into what they're into, and I'm no different. I had gone to interior design school, and I graduated with an interior design diploma, and that was a 3-year course of study, and so I was really a generalist at that point. But I decided I was ready to renovate my own house, and I thought, okay, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, and I'm going to use my own house as my laboratory and use it as my first project, so I'll have something on my resume to go out and look for a job with. And in the course of preparing the drawings and figuring out what I wanted and doing my shopping, I came across a kitchen company that I thought I would want to deal with, and they liked my drawings, and they were kind of impressed that I'd done them myself, and I explained my educational background. They said, well, are you looking for a job? And I said, well, yeah, probably I am. And they said, well, would you like to talk to us? And I said, great. So I was with them for the next 5 years, and that's kind of how my love affair with kitchens began, because really, you know, I always thought I would never want to focus on one room. I'm the kind of designers mostly have ADD, you know, and we always want to do something sure. That's different. Ooh, shiny. Ooh, this is going to be great fun, you know. But I got into the kitchen, I found, well, 225 kitchens later, I have never done two the same. So it's the same room, but they're never the same project because the clients are also different. Everybody wants something different. So it's really been a very, very interesting niche that I fell into.
No, I think it's great. You go, you know, when you say interior design, what it sounds like, you went from as a delicate interior designer type into a no-nonsense, get-it-together drill instructor. I mean, that's
well,
a story.
Yeah. You've got to survive, I'll tell you, because, you know, I don't like to make excuses for being female ever. I can more than hold my own, but you do come across some guys in the construction business who are, let's call them politely, diamonds in the rough. And they want to push, and they want to test, and they want to see how far they can push me. And boy, sure. I had to learn, you know, you're not going to push me around, or if you do, you're going to do it once, and that's it.
No, I love it. No, every second of it. And I think that's really the attitude that you have to take, because if you're not confident in what you do, then why should I hire you, quote, unquote? You hear me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it goes beyond gender when it comes to something like this. There's a there's mental toughness that you have to have.
Yes, no, absolutely. But by the same token, you know, what's interesting, I hear people say, oh, you know, I didn't want to work with such and such a kitchen designer because he was a man, and what does he know about working in a kitchen? And I think, gee, you know, that's not really politically correct in this day and age. And you know, you don't know. You should, if a person is professional and they've got lots of great credits, and that's the really more to the point, is check out their background and see what they've done up until now. And if they've got great references and they've got great work behind them, so it shouldn't matter whether they're green or blue or male or female. You know, if they're a professional, they know what to do with a kitchen design.
Oh, okay. No question. Granted, but the design goes beyond the design. I'm going to stand up for the females at this stage of the game, because if you get, and this is for the most part, and we know that the world is not black and white. It's not 100% either way. But you get a lot of guys who go in there and they know their design. They know exactly what's going to happen. But are they the same people that actually physically use the kitchen once it's done in the way that a kitchen can be used? And I really believe that, and I've never thought about this before until you just said it, that if a woman has the ability to do the design in the first place, get it together and get it right, you're going to have to think beyond the stove, beyond where the refrigerator is, and into how that's being used and the implications after it's installed.
Well, actually, you know, that's a really good point, but the National Kitchen and Bath Association, which is the association that governs our industry, has been around for over almost, I think, 60 years or something like that now, and they've developed a set of guidelines. So certified kitchen designers, of which I'm one, have to pass an exam and be, you know these guidelines inside out and backwards. And they've spent 60 years, literally, researching ergonomics in the kitchen and how the majority of people work in the kitchen and what is efficient and what is safe and what works and what doesn't. So it isn't really a matter of just having personal experience and bringing it to the project. It's a matter of the training and the accreditation, and that lets you know that the person that you're dealing with not only may have personal experience, which is a benefit, but has training, solid training, that's really going to back up any question or problem that a homeowner might have.
So in essence, the kitchen in and of itself, it has its own life, quote unquote. You can make a living room, you can make a bedroom, you can make a bathroom, but the kitchen has a life that goes beyond that initial design and that initial putting it together.
Oh, absolutely. It has, well, like we talked about, it's like NASA, you know, it's command control. That's where the heartbeat is. And it sounds hokey, but that's true. That is the central part of the house. And because everyone gathers there, because you nurture your family, it is really that and the bathroom and the bedroom, really, you could get along with really without any of the other rooms in your home. But those three are critical. And the kitchen is really at the top of the list.
I just got this figured out. You know, in all my experience, when I run up against someone like yourself, there's only two words that would describe how I would respond to someone like you. You ready?
Okay, hit me.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I like it. I've got you well trained already. That's perfect. And that's what I like my clients to say. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. It's there. Okay. Robin, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at.
Yes, renovationbootcamp.com. And actually, I've got my book is going to be launched in October. And prior to that, if people want to go to the website and sign up, there is a free download of an audio chapter. That's me reading it with some of my audio comments that I didn't have room for in the book. So I'm going to be putting more chapters of the book on the website as time goes on, so they should keep checking back. And there are also gifts and bonuses, so there's going to be lots going on there in the next few months.
Wonderful. And by the way, I'm an old Marine, so you need a little different hat there. You've got to have that Marine Corps DI hat. That gets the point across.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. Well, the photograph that I sent you was my formal outfit. Yeah. I have another outfit as well with a different hat, so that might have been more appropriate.
I got you. Hey, listen, Robin, thank you so much for joining us. I've had a great time with you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Hong Kong, good night.
Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Troubles are free. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow
your... I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions,
Hello.
The topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's get to the heart of the issues that face us right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your keys and to fly down the street in a trance.
Attorney Michael Hallmeyer with us for It's the Law section of Dresser After Dark. Michael, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. Always great to be with you.
Thank you so much for being here, and I want to talk about something tonight that we shouldn't even have to talk about, and I do not understand the court system, and after what I saw with the Anthony trial, I'm totally lost.
Well, welcome to the crowd. I hate to say it, that crowd includes regular folks like you and lawyers like me. I actually did listen to a lot of the closing arguments over the weekend, and I was very surprised by what came down.
Yeah. Now, by the way, Michael, I understand, and I truly, truly understand, and I'm not an attorney, but from the outside looking in, I understand that something has to be proven without a reasonable doubt. There is no question about that. So if they couldn't go for murder one, my goodness, the woman is out partying for a month when the kid's gone. She gets a tattoo on herself saying, you know, let's live and be wonderful again. Everything points to that woman doing the deed.
Well, unfortunately, that's correct. And remember, the standard in a criminal case is the government has to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond any doubt whatsoever, but beyond a reasonable doubt. So the fact that a juror may have a doubt doesn't mean that the prosecution failed to meet its burden of proof.
Sure.
If you're looking for perfection, you're never going to find it absent a confession or videotape that shows the person doing the deed. So, you know, here the question becomes, did the jury understand that first point of whether or not there could still be some doubt as long as it was not reasonable? They could go ahead and say that the prosecution met the burden. Or in your case, there's a fallback, there's a lesser charge that they could have convicted on if they had thought that an unlawful homicide had taken place, which would be murder two or possibly manslaughter, but perhaps the prosecution had failed to prove murder one, the premeditated murder. So with those fallbacks, the fact that the jury would go for neither of them, now they're not always available, but usually they are, means where was this jury? Were they listening to the evidence that was presented? And even if they thought that beyond a reasonable doubt, murder one hadn't been proved, who else could have possibly been involved? It didn't make any sense that there could be an alternative other than what was postulated by the prosecution.
And by the way, there was always Zanny the nanny that didn't even exist. Why would you tell stories like that if you didn't know something was going on?
Well, yes, and who parties hardy if their child, whom they seem to profess all this love and adoration for, is missing for 30 days? I wouldn't. I don't know any person in my regular circle of contacts, let alone friends, who would behave that way. If you were going to film a movie about it, you'd never cast it that way. You'd never script it that way because it would just not be believable. The activities that the mom engaged in after the baby disappeared were not the sort of activities that would incline anybody to think that she really cared about what happened to her daughter, whether she was directly responsible or not. It was like she just didn't care.
Yeah, and it wasn't hearsay, Michael. There were pictures. She was out partying night after night after night. So,
yeah.
Okay, now that said, did you see her when she went to court this morning? All of a sudden?
She sure was wearing a different shirt. And you know what? Her hair was down.
Absolutely.
Yep.
You know, and as she walked in, she was smiling. You know, she knows she's getting out of it. And she's going to be out, what is it, next Wednesday?
She's just about completely done serving the time that she's already served, satisfying the time requirement for the small little charges that she was convicted of, lying. Oh, and by the way, she was convicted of lying to investigators. What were the lies about? If she was innocent of the charge, then really, could she be convicted of lying about it? It seems a little inconsistent with the global view that the jury found. To me, that almost smacks that the jury knew they had to convict her of something. And I don't know if they got confused by what their obligation was, what their duty was, and how they were supposed to judge. That's actually the thing that, as an attorney, I'm most bothered by. Now, I'm not a litigator, and I don't deal with that side of the legal profession. I'm a business lawyer, and I don't go to court, but I have some litigation experience. I'm interested in litigation as a process, and I certainly care about what's going on in the criminal justice system in this country. And I'm not certain if the prosecution did such a bad job of proving the case as that the jury just didn't understand what their role was. And if you have ever been called for jury duty, Michael Ray, when you go down there, the people who actually show up, you sometimes wonder, is this the best we've got? Is this everybody from all walks of life who are contributing to our jury system? Or are we still seeing most regular folks, if you will, somehow getting out of jury service? And does that have something to play in the scenario that the jury doesn't understand what their responsibility is? It makes you wonder.
You know, there was one other area of this, and I don't know the why or the how of it. But, Michael, now I didn't watch this thing minute by minute. You know, I'd catch bits and pieces of it and some of the follow-up after it was done. And there was a kid who flipped off, quote-unquote, one of the jurors, and the judge gave him 6 days. Okay, fine. But what was that picture? Did you see it of one of the defense attorneys flipping off the I don't know who he was doing that to, but I don't know if it was the public or the prosecutors. But did you see that picture?
I did not. I think that's inexcusable behavior. There's a reason why the world is replete with lawyer jokes, but it's more than just jokes. People have a love-hate relationship with lawyers. They hate them until they need them, then they love them and they want their lawyer to pull every trick there is to get them off the hook. We all know that, and that's part of the guilty pleasure that people seem to get and why courtroom dramas are so popular. But still, it's inexcusable as a professional for attorneys to engage in that kind of behavior. Everybody knows better. It's really why the judge chided the attorneys on both sides for their misbehavior inside the court. You know, a child knows to behave better than that, and it's really inexcusable.
Michael, he was in front of the, and it looked like he was in the same position when they were interviewed on camera. The original attorney, the one from Cuba, was there, and then there was the one with the beard, the heavier set guy. And it was the heavier set guy that they showed, but they blocked off, you know, his hand, obviously. I don't know if he was flipping off the crowd or saying, you know, we won and this is what it is for you. I don't know. It's a total conjecture. But what I did see was that. And then prior to that, the lead attorney on the defense was saying something, you know, going right back to that, well, we have problems in this country, and I don't know if we should be in a country that kills people. What does that have to do with anything?
It really doesn't. But the problem with so many attorneys and why the profession can be held in such low regard is I think that the general population sees attorneys as a bunch of arrogant folks. They're arrogant because they have an understanding, they have knowledge, they have an education that other people don't have. Not that they couldn't, because believe me, there's very little that lawyers learn, whether in school or in practice, that the average person couldn't learn to do themselves. They may think that you've got to be some sort of godlike figure to be an attorney, and that's absolutely not the case. But an awful lot of attorneys are arrogant, and they walk around thinking that they are better than other folks, and that's a huge part of why why attorneys are held in such low regard. People feel that. They sense it. They even treat lawyers that way when they're going to hire them and work with them. It's something that lawyers should guard against, and the profession should work hard to try to improve its image. But other than a lot of talk about that, there isn't much effort that the profession is doing on an organized way to try to improve lawyers' reputation. And so you have people like these attorneys who are old enough to know better that they shouldn't behave this way. But, hey, they just won the big case. Their reputations are set forever. They're going to get a lot of business out of this, a lot of money and a lot of fame, and a lot of backslapping is going to come to them. Their egos are going to swell even more. And unfortunately, I don't think that bodes well for the system.
No, Michael, I would say that the attorneys were analogous to doctors in their relationships with their clients and patients. In the old days, the doctor was the be-all, end-all. The doctor said, you're going to die. The doctor said, you've got this. You did not contradict what the doctor said. Now, it's this, because some of the patient would walk in there, they're frightened. I would venture to guess, with the exception of working with businesses, if you're going to be a litigation attorney, the person that's coming to you, if you're on the defense side, is frightened to death. And anything you say, quote unquote, for the most part, goes. So you are in a godlike position, like the doctor was in a godlike position. And it's the same thing what you're dealing with, except for the fear factor, with a politician. Not a statesman, a politician. And there is that euphoria that goes along with it. And unless you're aware of it, there's nothing you can do to defense against it.
Exactly right. People go to an attorney for help. They need help that they can't provide for themselves. And they very much feel like they're putting their fate, if not their lives, with a doctor, but certainly their financial fate. And sometimes in the criminal system, the criminal justice system, it's their freedom at risk. And they need somebody else to protect them and to defend them and to stand up on their behalf. So they really come to an attorney in a position as a bit of a supplicant and putting themselves very much at the mercy of this professional that they're hiring. And at the end of the day, though, the attorney is a service provider. He is like a box boy at the grocery. He renders a service on behalf of the client. The client is the principal in the relationship. On the face of it, the client is supposed to make all the decisions and has the power. But, you know, the clients don't often realize that. Most of the time they feel they're very much powerless, and it's this person across the table, the so-called professional, who has all the power, including the power to save them. And it's unfortunate when lawyers take advantage of that situation knowingly or unknowingly and misbehave.
I really think the question comes down to who is working for who. And a great example of that is what we've seen in the town hall meetings over this past year or so with our elected officials. It's who's working for who. Looking down, condescending on the constituents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to belabor it. We've seen it. I have another question. I think what's going to go on with Casey Anthony, she's getting a tremendous amount of offers right now. I think there was one for $750,000 if she'll appear on a TV station, et cetera. Also, you know who's after her? This is really interesting. The porn industry. Now, this isn't hearsay. What they basically said is that they saw her, you know, dancing with her friends in the period of time when the baby was missing, that she said she's hot. So they've offered her a job in the porn industry to become some kind of a phenomenal star, et cetera, et cetera. Now, she's going to get sued for, obviously, court costs. There's other lawsuits that are going to happen. They're going to try to hit her financially with money. She could come away with owing about $200,000-$300,000. Now, I know that if you owe child support, you can't bankrupt it. If you owe money to the IRS, you can't bankrupt it. But if I were to be sued for $200,000 from some of these from some of the organizations that were part of the state, the question I have is, can I bankrupt it? Because that's her answer if they nail her.
Well, there's a very good possibility that she would be able to discharge all those debts that are not special in bankruptcy. And this kind of special debts that you cannot discharge in bankruptcy are those that you described. There are certain kinds of things like some taxes or even most taxes, some payroll taxes, and there are some other things one cannot discharge in bankruptcy. But general indebtedness can absolutely be discharged in bankruptcy, and that's the whole purpose. I don't know if she's going to be sued by government for unsuccessfully prosecuting her. She has an easy defense saying, look, I was found not guilty by a jury of my peers, and I shouldn't have to repay any portion of the cost of government improperly prosecuting me. She's probably on the other side of the aisle going to make an awful lot of money on the plus side.
Big time.
Because she's got her 15 minutes right now.
No, absolutely, and she'll probably take advantage of it because you saw her this morning. There was a cockiness about her that it was time for her to get in, get out, and so on and so forth. But let me give you a projection, and I'm not necessarily saying that this is going to be the be-all, end-all. This is just a projection in my best guess that within a couple of years from now, this is all going to catch up to her, and emotionally she's going to get hit when she realizes what's been done, what's gone on with her life. She can't go home now. She can't live with her brother. And you know what she said about her father and what she said about her brother also. So I venture to guess she's not welcome in those areas. I think she'll probably finish herself off in a couple of years. There's only so much you can do unless you're a total sociopath that won't catch up to you.
I understand that sentiment very well. I'm obviously disappointed in the jury verdict, and I believe it was a miscarriage, but I can't be certain. And under the circumstances, you know, I can't play God. I can't look into her heart and know the truth. I certainly hope that if she was innocent, and whatever happened was as it went the way that her attorneys seemed to have really stretched to invent, I hope that that actually was true and that everybody watching from afar was wrong. And if she in fact is guilty that, and the jury made a huge mistake, I hope, then that there's some kind of, comeuppance either in this life or the next. In a way, I think I sense this from you as well. I'm almost more concerned with, the system and the jury system. And what does this say about our ability to continue conducting trials if in fact she was guilty and this jury just blew it? Why did it blow it? What was wrong with, and what continues to be wrong in many cases with a jury system where people can't render the kind of justice that we have come to take for granted, the whole system could break down just on a failure of the jury system, let alone things like bias and buying judges and all the rest of that. So sure. In a sense, the bigger concern for me, more than the tragedy of this little baby and the mother herself, whether she got off or didn't get off scot-free, it's what does this mean about it? What does it say about our legal system? And I am very concerned about what it may say about the legal system.
No, absolutely. And Michael, it's the consequence. And with that, we've run out of time now. Website we can find you at?
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Oh, one other thing I want to leave it with this, and we can take it up next week. But my biggest concern, I was watching the people outside of the trial, you know, the average person on the street, and they were chanting.
Oh, yes.
Okay. But, you know, it's very interesting. If you listen to the chant and then you listen to the unions chanting against, and then you go to the Middle Eastern countries and they're chanting against, different words, but it's the same sound. I think we're becoming robots.
A great topic for next week. Absolutely right.
I'm making my note. Okay, Michael Homeier. See you next week. Take care. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks, Michael Ray.
Good night.
Good night.
Useless faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Incredible places.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just
Richard Geller with us, co-author of Oxygen Remedy, How to Control Sleep Problems Without Costly Medications. He's a pioneering and natural health advocate, best-selling author, and publisher of over 30 courses and coaching programs. He founded over 11 companies. He was one of the internet technology company Amazing Media. Another was a publishing company, and yet another developed custom clothing for busy executives. When he was a boy, he was diagnosed with debilitating asthma and even the fatal disease lupus, and he went from doctor to doctor, from medical center to medical center, but his medical problems grew worse and worse, and in 2005, he stumbled on a major body of medical research originating from a little-known Russian doctor and a scientist, and within 1 week, he took his last puff or pill of asthma medication. He studied this method with the world experts, and within a few years, had coached many prominent people and helped them cure their health problems. And let us say, Richard Geller, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening. How are you, Michael Ray?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. When we are dealing with oxygen is so critical, obviously. Without it, we would...
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kathy Puckett back with us. Dr. Kathy Puckett with us, co-author of Homeland Insecurity, former FBI psychological profiler in the counterterrorism unit. Hey, Kathy, welcome back.
Hi, Michael. Nice to talk to you.
How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I hope you can hear me okay. I'm on a cell phone, but I had to do it this way this time, but I hope this is okay.
Are you traveling around?
No, I'm stationary.
I meant, are you traveling? Are you having a good time?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm traveling and working, which is always a good time.
That's a great thing. Okay. All right, let's jump right into this. J.C. Dugard. Most of us know what happened to her. She was kidnapped and held captive for 18 years, had two kids, and they found her. They found her in a police station. But the point is, what is it about this that we should really take a look at? Is the public in and of ourselves, what should we look at, and what does this mean to us?
Well, you know, Michael, last week we talked about the Casey Anthony case, you know, of the murder of her daughter Kaylee, and or at least the death of her daughter Kaylee, and the verdict, the controversial verdict that ensued. And that was pretty much, a kind of a classic murder case where family members were involved. We're still not sure exactly how. Everybody has their own theories. But
anyway, let me hold you up for a second, Kathleen. Did you hear what was going on? They did not charge her mother with perjury.
Exactly.
We all heard a lie. What is going on with the court system?
Right. Now, you know, when we were talking about this, I totally understand your wonderment about this, and there's just been consternation everywhere. But what really struck me about that in comparison, in juxtaposition with the J.C. Dugard case, yeah, was that family from the outside, looking from the outside in, anybody driving by the house, anybody looking at any of the family out and about, looking at pictures of them, anything like that, seemed very normal on the outside. No one really knew what was going on inside that house, okay, or any of those houses of those people. However, the other day I was listening to a conversation, and it was some friends of mine were talking about the J.C. Dugard case, and basically, what they were saying was, how could it be that no one would, all of those years, that no one would have heard anything from the backyard, from this reinforced place that this guy kept her in for all those years, and they were out and about for years. Why didn't anybody ever notice anything strange or say anything about anything that they noticed about this couple who were not Mr. and Mrs. Normal, you know, sure, to all appearances? And it really struck me because, you know, in the context of you can even look at it, and I was looking at it from a security and even a national security context. You know, in this day and age, they have the saying in New York, see something, say something, and that was very, very appropriately followed by a street vendor who saw smoke pouring out of, you know, an SUV parked on Times Square in New York, which turned out to be full of explosives. Mm. Well, he said something, but there's always this interesting, well, when it comes to neighborhoods, when it comes to individual neighborhoods and people's homes or their castles, and there's a definite basic right to privacy that we all have. So we're constantly torn between, taking notice and taking action, or trying to ignore what we think is not our business and not following anything about it. You remember the Kitty Genovese case in New York?
Yeah, yeah.
When she was murdered very graphically and very in a very loud, horrible scene where people just pulled down their pulled their curtains and decided, I am not going to get involved there. Well, in this day and age, more people are getting involved, but there's still that tug between, and it's a legitimate tug. It's a legitimate, I think, teeter-totter between security and privacy that we all have to wrestle with in this society, particularly in our country.
Kathleen, you run into two areas here when something happens like that. Kathy, the one is, okay, I'm that person who sees something going on. To begin with, I'm frightened to death because the person who's killing that person out front can come after myself or my family. Secondly, look what happens to me in the news. Look what happens to me in court, whereby the defense team, if I'm on the prosecution team, or a witness for the prosecution, the defense team is going to eat me alive. And if there's anything wrong in my past, they're going to find out. And now all of a sudden, your entire world is there for the universe to see.
Right.
That's scary.
That's a really good point. Yeah, it's very scary. You're exposed.
Yeah.
And not only that, you're exposed in this 24/7 news environment where anything anybody does is totally up for grabs for anybody to comment on anywhere.
But let me tell you how I feel about things like this going on. If I saw some kind of a horrendous act like that, I would get involved so fast you couldn't see straight. Because I would want someone to get involved that was close to, if it happened to someone I love, someone in my family. So there's this camaraderie that we have to get, that this crime stuff is going way, way, way over the top here. And nobody's doing anything about it. And if you do anything about it, even if you're law enforcement, you get your hamstrung, you get your hands tied.
Exactly. And that's the tug. And, you know, it's if you're in law enforcement, as I was for so many years, and I still work cases with, that touch on legal matters, because if I do private consultation and there's investigation involved, that inevitably sometimes leads to court procedures, I get involved with law enforcement still all the time, federal and local. And talk about, you have your hands tied. I know that a lot of people think that the Casey Anthony case was an example of the prosecution not making their case because somehow they were unable to, make the full case. I think personally that they had a problem with the way they prosecuted the case. I think that they were overzealous, I think, and they overreached. I think they should have charged her with far less and built a case while she was
got so much more
in litigation. But
they would
still
invest it, got more.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. But since that prosecution is now history, it was still a really interesting, really contrast for me between what happened last week with the Casey Anthony case, and now, JC is coming forward with her. I guess she's written a book on her experiences, which I think was inevitable and probably is going to be, unlike a lot of these memoirs, I think, pretty valuable, because this was a person who was held against her will for 18 years of her youth.
Did she have the ability to escape?
Well, that's such an interesting question, because you're talking, and now there are two things that we have to consider in talking about that. Was she able to escape? Physically, perhaps. she might have had chances to escape. But by the time she was in a position where she was able to escape, not from the dungeon where she was kept, but when she was out and about with the guy and his wife, by then she had children. And she was protecting the children. And not only that, you know, define freedom. You know, could she have escaped? She was so, I mean, how old was she when she was, what, how old was she, nine, when she was captured?
Yeah, I think she was like 8 years old, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, she was a little girl. And so she was brutalized and really made, I mean, if you are taken into a prison, if you're a prisoner from the age of 8 or 9, your life and your psyche is very different from someone.
You know, your
who
lifestyle
grew
is
up.
The prisoner. Yeah, but, that, it, huh? But there's an area here that everything you're saying will be validated through this. The way they were caught, it was an unrelated matter. He walked her and the two kids into a police station.
Right.
You heard that, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he walked them into a police station, and
By then, I think, Michael, that he was pretty sure that he was immune. He had not been caught up until that point, and he had had what he had all those years.
Yeah, and she wasn't
really
going to say it?
No, the arrogance of the criminal mind and the ignorance of the criminal mind is really agonizing sometimes to look at. But I'm going to be interested to see her story because it's the most consistent. I mean, she is now very articulate, and she's going to be able to speak on behalf of a lot of people who have never been able to tell a story who've been through things like this.
Oh, no question there's value.
Yeah, well, the news value, but I think for purposes of psychology, you know, I'm looking at it from a, like, this is going to be very instructive to law enforcement and to, I mean, Child Protective Services and people like that already know this, but it's good to be reminded, you know, of the real serious dynamic that goes on between the captor and the captive. You know, the Stockholm syndrome and everything else that we've become accustomed to talking about all of these years. It's, you know, there was a book written by, on behalf of, I guess, a child soldier from Africa, which I tried to read it and I was unable to read it because his life was so hideous. From a little child, he was forced to kill for the dictator and the troops of that country. A child soldier, 7 years old.
When I said value before, what I meant value was not for news value. I don't care about news value. I really don't. I look at it today and I see what it's become. There's this thin line between entertainment and the news itself. And the news bleeds through to entertainment. And look what they did with the Casey Anthony trial. Did you see those people running to get tickets? I mean, it was like a zoo in there.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and everybody was Casey Anthony, whatever happens. So she got off. No, she didn't get off. Unless she's a complete and total sociopath, she has got to live with herself. And I wouldn't be surprised in 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now if you didn't find her hung in a closet somewhere. Not somebody did it. She'll do it to herself.
No, I think that's a real far-seeing kind of thing to say, Michael, because I have a feeling, I think you're absolutely right. I think that Casey Anthony's life will be a series of disasters. I hate to say that, but
that's not where we're at. And I know that, and I know you well enough. Yeah, that's not where I'm at with that either. But the point of contention is, the major porn industry are offering her a job. They said she's hot, and you know they want her, and she could make millions of dollars. But the point of contention is she's got to live with herself. And if there's any justice, she's going to dole it out to herself.
And there's no amount of money. Inevitably, it always turns out that there's just no amount of money that can quench that despair that, you know, will be the focus of her life.
Yeah, because when it comes down to it, if you saw the pictures, I'm sure you did, of she and her daughter, there was an attraction there. There was a mother-daughter thing going on. I don't know what else happened, but there was that. And that's going to come back to it. And I don't get with the parents when they just walked right out of court. So there's lessons in all of this to be learned. And I really think if we go back to if we go back to the original youngster we were talking about, the JC, then maybe what happened to her can save lives in the future.
Exactly, Michael. That's why I wanted to talk about it tonight with you, because I just thought that the it was such a clear dichotomy between what we talked about last week and what was all over the news. And then now, I mean, the J.C. Dugard, I can't say her last name, was a big story too. But in this case, she is articulate enough to really talk about, what did happen and how it happened. And I understand that she does it very well. So I'm really, this book I will read.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I got it down loud and clear, and there's a lot of lessons in it. And if you think about it, this youngster, and I don't care how old she is, her life stopped at a certain age. And so what did she have, a total of a fifth grade education, something like that. So there was all of those years that she didn't get a chance to grow. She may have come back. She may be a mother. Physiologically, you can be a mother. But she's going to come back, and she's still a youngster, and she still has a lot of growing up to do.
Well, that's one thing. I think you're probably very right. I think that the advantage that she has going for her is that she appears to be extremely bright, and I think she's really, really made a lot of progress since she's come back to the normal world.
Well, good for her. And you can imagine, if I was her father, knowing that all of those years she was that close and we couldn't find her, but at the same time, I would be ecstatic just to get her back.
Exactly. Yeah. It really seems. Yeah. The two stories were just very striking to me. So I'm glad we had a good discussion about it. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. And my only concern, we got about a minute or two to go, but my only concern realistically is what's going on in the court systems today. The quote unquote entertainment aspect of it. Now, obviously the jurors, they did what they did. They found out that there was nothing that was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So we can buy that. There's no question about that. But the attorney, with a picture of the attorney from the defense, flipping off the crowd, what kind of professionalism is that? I'm sure you saw the picture.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes.
I don't get that. I really, truly don't get that. And then the lead attorney.
It's a circus. It's a total circus.
And the lead attorney talking about a country that kills people. I don't get that one at all. There's got to be consequence for somebody killing someone. And if it's not life imprisonment. And that's one of the biggest problems I think we have. Kathy, there's no more consequence for anything. You can do just about anything you want to do. And if you got somebody sharp enough and if you've got the right defense, you're going to walk. Look at OJ.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Although I've heard that he's quite miserable in prison right now.
Oh, yeah. That was on some. Well, look what he did. He walked in with guns. Not bright.
Yeah.
All right. Let me ask you this. Where can we find you on the website, and where can we buy the books?
We have a kind of outdated but still good blog, homelandinsecuritytheblog.com, Michael. And you can buy the books from there or on Amazon.
Yeah. By the way, I'm having this major problem here. Do you have any cats?
Cats? No. I have
dogs. Do you know anything about cats? My sister has a cat, and the cat is a little over a year or so old. And she is the cutest thing that you'll ever want to see. But the poor little thing is in heat, and she will not leave me alone.
I had the same thing. A brother-in-law had that problem.
Everywhere I go, she tackles my foot. She does pole dances on my equipment. But whatever. I keep telling her, no, I'm not a cat. Go away.
Good luck with that. Good luck with that, Michael.
Oh, I think it's going to be called good skill. How can I hide? Kathy, we'll see you next week. Take care.
Talk to you next week, Michael. Bye-bye.
Okay, good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Tal Yanni is with us. He is the author of Life is Not a Candy Store. It's the Way to the Candy Store. It's a spiritual guide to the road of life for teens. And my goodness, in today's world, there should be one. During his formative years, he wasn't too happy with his reality. What he was creating in his life wasn't in alignment with what he wanted in his heart or what he knew and deeply felt was possible. And as a struggling student, he was considered a troublemaker at school. And then one day during a bike trip from the kibbutz to the sea, he was asked to take charge and make sure none of the other kids lagged behind. And for the first time in his life, at age 15, he got a taste of what it meant to be to assume responsibility and be a leader. And Tal, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when I understand that when you were a kid, you learned you were dyslexic. And let me give you a quick feel about that. When I was in high school, I graduated high school with C's and D's and almost didn't make it through. Now, I wasn't stupid, and the information came very quick to me, and I understood things, could never pass a test. So when I got into, I joined the Marine Corps right after high school, and I got my very first pair of glasses, and you know what? They told me I was dyslexic. And all those years, I couldn't put it together. Anybody who knew me knew I wasn't stupid, but at the same time, I couldn't pass the test. I was confusing the numbers and letters and everything else. What a horrendous thing for a kid if you don't know that's what you have.
Yeah, and welcome to the club, because there are many of us. And I actually, I was told that only when I was a 10th grader. And by then, it was kind of almost too late, because the frustration over the years really just built. And I couldn't tell what was the problem. And you sit in the classroom you know, embarrassed, and just hope that nobody would ask you to solve a problem or to read something.
Sure.
So you start to be the funny guy or the troublemaker, depends on the teacher pretty much. But, you know, to the point when you don't mind to go to the dean's office over as long as they don't ask you to read in front of everybody.
Yeah, no question about it.
It's really a tough way to grow up.
Yeah, now, by the way, and today you teach Hebrew, you teach Judaic studies at Temple Beth Hillel in the San Fernando Valley. See, and it's moving beyond that, and I think that in and of itself is the big problem. It's the strategies to be able to get yourself through those things, and I think a lot of kids that are plagued with these kind of problems, they don't have the steps to take to get to where they should be, and they start to feel worse about themselves.
Exactly, and it's one of the reasons I went into teaching is that I, you know, many teachers go into teaching because they're this one great teacher who really influenced them and really pushed them hard, and they wanted to do the same. I did not have that one teacher, and so I also grew up in a, as you mentioned, on a kibbutz in Israel, which is a secular society. I had to come all the way to Los Angeles to become a believer, and it really opened to me a new door, a new world. And I put the two together, understanding my limits or my difficulties, and all of a sudden realized that I was not alone, that there was a purpose to life, that there was a God. All that was so big, so great, and I decided that I want to, if I could only share it, if I could only go back in time and do things differently. And when I realized I couldn't, I said, I want to share it with people that, you know, with kids, with students. If I could, I could not go back in time, I would go into the classroom and tell it to students. And that's why I went to and got my teaching credential here in Los Angeles in social studies, and went into the classroom and started to really pay attention to the struggle in students. And I saw it was really working. I could really help them go through the semester and finish the semester, kids that otherwise would not be able to do that.
I think one of the most important things.
Rewarding.
I think one of the most important things, and kids today especially, they don't experience a value within themselves. And once they find that, then they can get on a path. But unless they feel accepted and have an identity, and it's the identity that's so important, it either gets them into trouble or it moves them on a path to be able to have a decent life.
I agree, and it comes from just the fact that by age, if you're growing up and you are frustrated and you are a troublemaker and you are the one that gets into fight, by the time you are age 15, you think that that's really who you are and who you always have been.
Sure.
Instead of realizing that it is not you, it's the process of life that brought you to that point, but there is a way to change it. And that's the purpose of the book, is really to tell people, teenagers and even parents, first have the power to stop, to say, just a second, let me figure out what is going on. And that's how the book came about.
No, by the way, that what happened to you was probably the greatest gift you could have ever had. Had you not had the dyslexia, had you not had the problems that you had as a child or as a youngster, you would not be doing what you're doing today, helping the kids that you're helping. I really believe in my heart of hearts that anything that happens to anybody is it's a wake-up call. And if you can look through the wake-up call to see the reality of what you're meant to do, it's called finding purpose. And I think the heart of spirituality is to find your own purpose in life.
I agree. And I mean, even though it was a painful, really painful 18 years or
sure.
so, or 23 actually, until I could connect the knowing that I what were my problems, and also connecting them in age 23 when I started to believe in God, it was really a painful journey. Not so much during that time, because it's what you are, it's what you know. So you don't walk every day feeling, hey, that, you know, I'm in pain. It's only later when you get over it and you can look back and you realize how painful it is to live with those problems and within the limitation of your five senses, nothing else, because nothing else exists. And so, but I agree with you that it is a gift, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing today. In addition to the fact, when I grew up and I looked and I saw that as adults also we keep going without a purpose and we're hurting each other and we don't really stop and think, and that's where the name candy store came, because I see around me people that just grab whatever they can, like there is no tomorrow. And we just hurt each other. It's one thing if you do it as a child, if you do it as a teenager, and you grow up, you understand it's not the way. But today people just mature late. So and we keep doing, you know, we keep going with the same behavior again and again and again, from one relationship to another, from one job to another, from one struggle to another. And we just rifting from one event to another instead of taking charge of our destiny and telling herself, I don't want to continue with that. I want to stop. I want to find something bigger, something more meaningful. And that's, again, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to tell people, to have the self-discipline to stop, to think, to ask questions. Nothing is more rewarding than going on that journey on the way to the candy store. Getting there, we will all get there one day. But if you do you travel the journey and enjoy yourself, that's the reward by itself. Finding a purpose and living that purpose, that's the reward. It's not going to prevent you from, you will still, like everybody else, have difficulties in life, but you will deal with them differently, and you will overcome them, and it's not going to be a big deal as it is. Not everything will be a drama in your life because you have a different look at life, and that's a reward by itself.
Oh, sure. And I think the kids today are especially challenged, Al. They're especially challenged because they have a tremendous amount of drugs and a tremendous amount of freedom and a tremendous – when I say freedom, it's not the kind of freedom that causes a person to be free, but there's no consequence. They get into trouble, and it's so what? It's always somebody else's fault. And that's what has to be looked at, and that's what has to be dealt with. When I was a kid many, many years ago, the world wasn't like the way the world is today. There wasn't the drugs that were available the way they're available today. The movies didn't have the abundance of sex and death and dying and everything else that goes on out there. And those kids today are exposed to it. They're exposed to it when they're in the fifth, the sixth, the seventh grade. They know more than we knew as young adults way back when. And all of those things have to be taken into consideration. And the thing that will cause them to make that move, make that turn, is when they realize that there is more value in walking away from that stuff than there is in participating.
Right, and it's actually one of my favorite tricks in the classroom is when I realize that I have a student, a troublemaker, and I would ask him or her to stay after class, and I would say, look, you are one of my best students. I have a problem as a teacher. So let's walk through it together, and you tell me, what should I do next time that you talk in class? And they will come with solutions. They will say, well, so just move me to sit somewhere else. And, okay, so what next if you keep talking? Well, should I call your parents? No, don't call my parents, but maybe you'll send me to the office. And they give me kind of a roadmap to how to deal with them. And I give them, at the end, I say, all right, so you told me what to do. I really appreciate it. Thank you. And let's do it together. Make sure that let me help you become a good student. And it's kind of it forced them to change without putting the blame on the teacher or anyone. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them really changed overnight and become good students. And I learned the trick and I used that. And instead of just getting angry with them. And it's great. So it's putting the responsibility where it belongs. And for me as a teacher, as a father, I try to assume more the role of a guide, less of somebody who tells them what to do, but guide them if it's through discussions, if it's through setting the rules together, guide them to where I think they should go, but letting them take the responsibility.
Sure,
and I know that they will, many times they will fail, which is okay. It's part of the process. I want to see them trying. I want to see them overcoming we all have difficulties. So whatever it is, if they try to overcome it, it's worth anything that I would get by just sending them to the dean's office or just punishing my own kids or whatever it would be.
Well, I think the brilliance is that is they've created their own consequence. And when they've created their own consequence, they can't point a finger at somebody, say, it's your fault, you did it, they've done it. And that's teaching, you said the word, it's teaching responsibility.
Yeah, and the parents, when I talk to the parents afterward, kind of to give them an update, they start laughing because they think it's a great idea. And the kids sometimes, many times, just don't know what to do, don't know how to react. No one ever asked them to be responsible to their own action, especially not in the classroom, in such a way that actually forces them to grow up, to mature.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that it's lacking, which is, it's okay. Everything that, I mean, being immature for a teenager, that's part of nature. I'm not trying to change nature. I'm not going against nature. But I'm trying kind of to contain it. For the teenager, it's really to help them grow up and survive that period of time. And when some of the parents, when they come to me and when we talk about spiritual thing, activities that I'm doing in the class, and they are worried that their kids are not that interested in it, I always tell them, that's okay. I'm putting the seeds right now. Some of them right away grab it and really get into it and really enjoy the activity, and really helps them to figure out things about themselves. Others, not so much, but they already heard something. They already heard about loving yourself instead of being too hard on yourself. They already heard about the whole process of going from point A to point B and being awake, not sleepwalking through life. And even if it's not now, it's when they will become young adults or when they will become parents, something there will wake up in the right time. I'm not trying to change all of them. I'm kind of sending my message out, and you want it, you take it. You don't want it, no harm, no foul. You move on in a different direction.
That's really the way to do it. Tal, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and the book?
Yes, it's talyanai, which is talyanai.com. And in Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, the book is there. And so far it's getting great reviews, so I'm actually very happy with it.
Wonderful. By the way, thank you so much for joining us, and I've appreciated your time. And I'm listening very closely to you, and some of the things that you're saying, more people should be dealing with the kids that way. Responsibility is a very powerful thing. Taliani,
thank you so much
for joining us. Take care. Good night.
Thanks.
Comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtains falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter